I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump was impeached last night after 10 hours of rancorous debate in the House of Representatives. There was one argument in defense of President Trump that has raised a lot of eyebrows. Here's Representative Loudermilk, Republican from Georgia, saying that Pontius Pilate treated Jesus Christ better than the Democrats were treating Donald Trump.
When Jesus was falsely accused of treason, Pontius Pilate gave Jesus the opportunity to face his accusers. During that sham trial, Pontius Pilate afforded more rights to Jesus than the Democrats have afforded this president in this process.
Fred Keller, Republican from Pennsylvania, quoted Jesus on the cross when he asked God to forgive those who had wronged him, quote, for they know not what they do. There are deep divisions between Republicans and Democrats over a whole host of political issues, as well as divides between young and old and urban and rural, whites and people of color, the coasts and the heartland, the north and the south, and between the religious and the non-religious. In fact, the so-called God gap or religiosity gap is growing. Today in Radio Times, religion and politics, how the two are intertwined, and how religion is playing out in the 2020 presidential race. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Anthea Butler is Associate Professor of Religious Studies and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's currently a Presidential Fellow at Yale Divinity School, working on a book on evangelicals and racism. Anthea Butler, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us, Michelle Margolis, and she's an Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of a book called From Politics to the Pews, How Partisanship and the Political Environment Shape Religious Identity. She was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book, which has won a number of awards. And Michelle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's fact check Representative Loudermilk and Anthea Butler. I will turn to you, but it's important to get things straight when talking about politics and certainly talking about religion.
Go ahead. It is. And the first thing I'm going to say is Representative Loudermilk just went a bridge too far yesterday. And as I said on Twitter, if Donald Trump is Jesus, I'm Rihanna. So let's start there. I think that one of the things that people might miss underneath this is that evangelicals like to exhibit a persecution complex. This is part of their narrative. This is part of their religious narrative. And because they love Donald Trump so much, they are willing to put him in the story of Jesus Christ. And I actually want to use a Philadelphia priest, my favorite person, James Martin, S.J., and I want to read what he said on Twitter. Pilate had Jesus beaten and whipped, thrown in the jail overnight, marched through the streets carrying his cross, and then nailed to that cross until he died. Comparing the treatment received by the president to what Jesus suffered is absurd. Also, only one of them is sinless. And I don't think anybody could say it any better than that. I mean, it's just the truth. This whole charade of making Donald Trump either, depending on how you look at it, Cyrus, you know, the one who's going to deliver evangelicals to some better place, all of the stuff that's happened with impeachment and them still backing him, despite the fact that they've crammed their morality down everybody's ears for the past 45, 50 years. And now they decide to follow after Donald Trump, to me, is absolutely ludicrous.
And I do want to spend time not talking about our president. I'm looking at you, Michelle, but help us understand about the role that religion plays in our personal life. And when you look at other countries like France or England or other countries, it seems that we are a more, broadly speaking, a more religious country or have more people that have a religious faith.
Absolutely. I mean, America, from a kind of Western democratic viewpoint, is still much more religious than our counterparts that you've discussed. And that's really important. And in particular, that our religion is very closely intertwined with our politics. And so building off of Anthea's point, and we don't need to spend too much time talking about the president impeachment, is even if we think that the history of what these Republican leaders are saying as it relates to the Bible, it's a shrewd political move because it's making a call that if you are a religious person, this is how you should be viewing the impeachment trials and the voting. And so that they're able to basically send a signal that says, if you are religious, if you believe these things about the Bible, if the Bible and the Word of God and Christian, in particular Christian faith, white Christian faith, is important to you, this is how you should interpret the political world around you. They're giving you a lens through which to see the world. And in that way, it's a very smart move to be invoking religion at this time if you were a Republican.
Let me just do a quick follow-up, and then, Anthea, I'll go back to you. But looking at then Republican Party and looking at religion, which comes first, chicken or the egg, religion or politics?
So that's a tricky question, right? So I wrote a whole book the argument that politics can shape your religious identity. There is a nuanced argument. I don't think your politics can affect your religious beliefs and behaviors at all points in your life. But I do make the argument that for many people, we have this strong political identity, and sometimes it's formed at a time when religion is sort of on the back burner. And if that's the case, then your politics can be affecting these religious decisions. And I think we're seeing that in a world that the current political world that we're in is that you have these people who are Republicans. They care a lot about Republicanism and being a Republican. And in light of that, they're able to change some of their views about their faith, how their faith should intersect with politics, how can they support Donald Trump. They're able to go through some mental gymnastics to keep these things in check. But if we thought that religion was just driving politics, we would expect people to say, Trump does not work for us. But the fact that we see this kind of movement in people's attitudes about morality, about religion, who Donald Trump is within the biblical story, I think is telling us something about how people are viewing the religious world a little differently on account of their politics.
Anthony, I was doing some research in preparation for the show, and again, sort of broadly speaking, that when you look at people who are secular, who are those N-O-N-E-S, those nuns, or not people who are not of a particular faith, they seem to be more drawn to the Democratic Party, except for African Americans. There seems to be this powerful connection between Black people of faith and the Democratic Party, in contrast to what Michelle was just saying.
Yeah, I think that's been something that it's been – for me, it's not difficult because I'm an African-American religious historian, but I think it's difficult for other people to see, in part because what they can never square away is the fact that a lot of African-Americans, especially those who are more conservative, have conservative sort of political religious values but vote politically more liberal with the Democrats, okay? And I think that comes about, you know, in part because of the Civil Rights Movement, in part because of the ways in which the Black church has been accommodating to different kinds of groups, even though, you know, in a lot of cases it can be very homophobic, right? So I think that for the nuances that we miss are often the kinds of nuances that come with belief. So I was listening about what you were saying about how people believe, whether it's religion or politics. Sometimes the religion folds into politics in a certain kind of way. And I think what we miss, especially about evangelicals, is that this has been an arc that's gone on for, you know, at least 70 years, 75 maybe. And because of the ways in which religion has unfolded itself with a particular kind of party, it's hard to see where they separate, right? And so now I think what we see in this particular time period that we can't account for in the polls is the ways in which religion and politics have morphed into one. And we don't see the division so clearly because of the ways we talk about it and conflate certain kinds of things.
Well, I'm thinking, Michelle, I mean, in certain ways, you know, families will grow up, they'll say, well, we're a Democratic family or we're a Catholic family. I mean, is there really a division when you look at sort of where this all comes from? Is there a division between politics and religion, or are they sort of all sort of combined, intertwined even within the family dynamics?
I think a couple generations ago, I would say absolutely they are separate. I think now it's getting a little trickier to say that, because the idea is when you're raising a family and you're in a family unit, you are trying to raise your children to have a certain set of values. And those values take the form of political values and religious values. But those things are very tricky because it might be about how you feel, not just about abortion, but women in general, women's empowerment and kind of feminism in general. And so if that's something that's of value to you that you want to pass on to your children, you may not want to be going to a conservative church that's going to be espousing different sets of principles. And then I think I want to just build off of something that Anthea just said, which is this important point of when she – I think we just need to be careful that when we talk about evangelicals today, we are talking about white evangelicalism.
Yes.
For all the reasons that Anthea said. And so in my book and in my work, right, I'm very careful to distinguish that, because I think – especially as a Caucasian scholar of religion, I guess this is a radio.
Yes.
As a Caucasian woman, yeah. Being very cognizant of the fact that when we say religion or we say evangelicalism, we're thinking about white Protestant theology and the idea that black Protestant theology is quite different and that you could be a biblical literalist and hold views that push you toward the Democratic Party because it's about justice and the breaking off the yoke of oppression and all of these things that developed in the sense that when the black church developed on account of segregation and racism. And so thinking about the religion and politics being intertwined on the political right is a very white thing. And religion and politics, and I think we're going to talk about this a bit, on the left is much more of a person of churches of color and people of faith who are of color.
I wonder, Anthea, though, looking at certain issues, whether it is abortion or gay marriage or school prayer, some of these, you know, so-called hot button issues, whether that has, if we talk about a God gap or a religiosity gap, how much do you think those particular, or even as we call family values, how much that has sort of driven a wedge in between people of faith?
I think it has. I mean, I think one of the things that when I look at where we are right now, to think about is we don't really there's a move towards this, but let me say that people of faith who tend to be liberal are sort of just washed away. And what happens is that you don't talk about people who are good churchgoers or Methodists or somebody like that who go to church every Sunday, who, you know, may have some conservative beliefs, may not have some conservative beliefs, but they are not as strident as white evangelicals are. Okay. And so these people are completely missed in the voting pools and the way that we poll everything. Nobody wants to pay attention to them. It ends up being between black churchgoers and white evangelicals, and everybody else drops down into a sieve that nobody looks at. And I think this election cycle, especially for Democrats, people need to look at this because there's a phrase that a friend and I have been talking about a lot, and that is justice Democrats. So if you start to think about people like William Barber, you know, some of the major pastors around this country who are more liberal but have a social justice bent, this is why people are going after people like Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, because they want justice. They just don't want, you know, abortion or same-sex marriage to be rescinded. What they want is to see the kind of justice that rolls down like waters, like King talked about, the kind of justice that people don't have to be poor anymore, that they get a living wage, that these student loans are unburdened. You see where I'm going,
right? I do, absolutely. We're almost up in a break here, but Michelle, do you think that by calling things about justice rather than the sort of tropes, I would say, of probably the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, does that make for a different conversation?
I think it absolutely does, because it changes the policy dimension, right? And so when we talk about justice, we're no longer talking about the family values of abortion and gay marriage. When you're talking about justice, you're talking about all the issues that Anthea just mentioned. And so it's changing the narrative of the debate about how can a religious person support the Democrats? Well, if you're looking at it through the lens and the frame of justice, there's only one party that works for you. If you're thinking about it through the lens of family values and traditional values, then there's only one party for you. And depending on what frame and what lens you're looking through, it's going to dramatically change how you see the political world.
Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Michelle Margolis. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Anthea Butler is associate professor of religious studies and Africana studies, also at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about religion and politics, how they are intertwined, this thing called a God gap or a religiosity gap. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Michelle Margolis and Anthea Butler. I have to say, an interesting conversation off the air and on the air. We're talking about religion and politics today, how the two are intertwined and how religion is playing out in the 2020 presidential race. Let me play a clip from New Jersey Senator and presidential hopeful Cory Booker, speaking in August at the Black Church Presidential Candidate Conversation Series in Atlanta, Georgia, talking about his faith.
But y'all, I gotta call it out. It says I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me. Now, Christ does not strengthen you to sit on the sidelines. Christ does not strengthen you to sit on the couch. This is not a spectator sport. Martin Luther King said it best. When his era, in his moral moment, he said we have to repent in our day and age, not just for the vitriolic words and violent actions of the bad people, but the appalling silence and inaction of the good people. And so I want to call the faith community together, because faith without works is faith without works is. And we need to bring this nation back to life. There is too much death. There is too much darkness. And if the faith community does not lead, we will never make it to the promised land.
And again, Cory Booker speaking this past summer. I mean, Anthea, he sounds like a preacher.
Yes, he does. And not only does he sound like a preacher, I wrote a piece about him back last, I think, February. And I said he was Martin Luther King light. And that is true, because he has invoked King a lot on the campaign trail. He's talked about love a lot, which is a very central piece of King's theology. And I think that he's very bright. What you didn't, if you had a real listening ear and you knew scripture, the way that he quoted that scripture where he said, I could do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me, he was using the King James Version. So he already knew how to get to a black church, because a lot of black churches use the King James Version of the Bible. So already there was a touch point, right? And then his cadence and everything else. Now, how has that worked for him on the campaign trail? Not so well. And so I think that this is the moment where we have to think about how are those religious sorts of tropes working out in the practical election cycle on the Democratic side. And I think that's actually much an interesting question to ask about Cory Booker. And it might be why he's not getting the traction that he needs to get.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. Let me play one more clip. And this is South Bend Mayor and Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. He's speaking in April at the LGBTQ Victory Fund National Champagne Brunch in Washington, D.C. He's talking about his gay identity, his faith, also talking about Vice President Mike Pence, who in the past has supported conversion therapy, actually signed a law in Indiana that allows businesses to deny service to LGBTQ people on religious grounds. Let's listen to candidate Pete Buttigieg.
You may be religious and you may not, but if you are, and you are also queer, and you have come through the other side of a period of wishing that you weren't, then you know that that message, that this idea that there is something wrong with you, is a message that puts you at war not only with yourself, but with your maker. And speaking only for myself, I can tell you that if me being gay was a choice, it was a choice that was made far, far above my pay grade. And that's the thing I wish the Mike Pences of the world would understand. That if you got a problem with who I am, your problem is not with me. Your quarrel, sir, is with my creator.
And again, that was Pete Buttigieg talking just a couple of months ago about his faith and also being a gay man. And I wonder, Michelle, I mean, it is interesting, I think, again, broadly speaking, that we think of Democratic candidates as being a little more secular. Even if they are people of faith, they kind of keep it more privately. But what we heard both from Cory Booker and also from Pete Buttigieg is they're putting it out there.
Yeah, and personally, I think it's a great strategy, at least if the numbers aren't lying, is that people on the Democratic front. So on the one hand, you might say the Democratic candidates shouldn't talk about religion. Religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, is now the largest constituency within the Democratic Party, right? So there are more religious non-identifiers than any other faith. So you might say, oh, these people we need to appeal to them. But on the flip side, a lot of those people say that they're non-identifiers, but they're not necessarily opposed to faith. The overwhelming majority of them believe in God or higher power. And so speaking about their faith, but through a liberal or democratic angle is a very smart strategy, because you're not going to be alienating the overwhelming majority, even of the religious non-identifiers, and you're going to appeal to the 70% of the Democratic Party who do belong to a faith. And so it seems like a win-win strategy on the Democratic side, I think.
Well, and this gets us to this Pew Research Center study that came out about a month or so ago. Just quoting from the front page here, a large majority of Americans feel that religion is losing influence in public life. While some say this is a good thing, many more view it as a negative development, reflecting the broad tendency of Americans to see religion as a positive force in society. Should that surprise us, Anthea?
No, and I'm going to say something very different. I keep wanting to find out who Pew is calling.
Because why do you say that?
I say that because, you know, when you have pollsters and they're dialing landlines, you're getting older white people who have not cut that cord, right? And so you miss all the people who are have gone straight to cell phones and everything else. And so while I am appreciative of what Pew does, I always have the question in the back of my mind is that who is the sample set and who are you calling and why?
And you're saying it's not young people?
Yeah. And it's not the people who might have a different way to skew this. Now, that all being said, I think that, you know, people, part of what is happening is twofold. I think one is that people are afraid of this going away because if you're a white evangelical, you want religion to be in the center of everything, right? You want that to be part of what you do and part of your life in America. For the people who are like, I'm tired of this and I don't want this anymore, it's because they've been so oversaturated with it in presidential campaigns and other kinds of campaigns that they see this as hypocrisy. Huh. And they don't want any, you know, they don't want anything to do with it. It's sort of like all the politicians who claim a religious thing and then the next thing you know, they're being, you know, arrested or accused of some sexual transgression or something like that. And so this to them looks hypocritical. And also the church is hypocritical. I mean, we could go on and talk about, you know, Catholic Church sex scandals or Protestant sex scandals. We could talk about financial scandals, all of those things. And I think this is where that polarization starts to come in. It's not just through one place. It's through many different places.
Michelle, let me just go back to the study and just quote something else here. Taking what Anthea said in mind here, U.S. adults are resoundingly clear in their belief that religious institutions should stay out of politics. Now, maybe it depends on what your politics are or which religious institution you're talking about. But it is this interesting kind of split that we have about religion and politics and perhaps goes back to our founding.
Right. So I'm going to say something. So the glass half empty version of how you can interpret the Pew results is that Americans are inconsistent and we don't know what we want. The positive glass half full perspective is that we're complicated. So the idea that we could be saying religion is losing influence in public life, and most people think that's a bad thing, but at the same time, we don't want religious leaders actually interfering in politics, which would be a main way through which we would expect to see religion's influence in society. The fact that we can see these two sets of numbers at the same time from the same people answering the exact same questions, right. We might say these people don't know what they want. But it turns out, I think it's just that we're complicated, that people do think, people aren't hostile toward religion necessarily. They do still in America see it as a general force of good. But when it comes to politics in particular, there is this feeling that we don't want it on, that there's something dirty about it, that we don't want the dirty secular world of politics inside the pews. That being said, most people who go to church, I think also in that study, so I don't want to jump ahead, say that they think that their own pastors talk about faith about the right amount. So that
right.
says something about whether
well,
people
about that.
Like their pastors or that they're self-selecting into a church that either they don't want politics being talked about, so they find a church where the pastor doesn't talk about politics, or they want to hear left-wing politics, or they want to hear right-wing politics, and they find their church accordingly. But consequently, even if people say, I want religion out of politics in the general, most people are actually happy with their own houses of worship and what their religious leaders are doing.
Is that the confirmation bias that we hear about, that we sort of trend towards yeah. the people that tell us what we believe? But there is this Johnson Amendment, Anthea, which is mm-hmm. that pastors are not allowed to endorse candidates. I mean, I think that's probably broken every Sunday. I don't know.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I remember back, they used to do these Justice Sundays in October during the presidential campaigns and off-season things. And they would just all say, here's all the people you do. If you were going back to church in the 90s, you would have, the Christian Coalition would actually have pamphlets to pass out in churches to tell you the slate of who to vote for. So this has gone on all the time. It, you know, the amendment, it doesn't matter. People are doing this anyway. And so I think when we let political figures come into the pulpits and preach, whether that's in a black church or you're in a white church and you're at, you know, a conference that says, let's pray for Donald Trump right now, pray for whoever leader that there is that you're supposed to be praying for. All of these things get thrown into the wash and nobody cares about the amendment. They just do it.
That is Anthea Butler, and again, Associate Professor of Religious Studies and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's been a Presidential Fellow at Yale Divinity School, working on a forthcoming book about evangelicals and racism. Michelle Margolis is an Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Wrote a book just a while back called From Politics to the Pews, How Partisanship and the Political Environment Shape Religious Identity. And since we are deep into the 2020 presidential election or political elections, it's important to talk about this intertwining of religion and politics. We got a bunch of people that want to join our conversation. Let's see what Mary from Bala Cynwyd has to say. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is for either of your guests, both of your guests. What explanation can you give for why evangelicals seem to preference the Old Testament over the New Testament? Most of what they seem to talk about is a very Old Testament emphasis. They seem to have forgotten what Jesus came to do in terms of preaching mercy and forgiveness.
It's a good question.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Mary, thanks for calling into Radio Times. They are looking at each other, but they're both smiling and nodding. And one of them is nodding their head. Michelle, do you want to start? And then, Anthea, I'll toss it over to you.
I don't have a great answer. And I think it's tricky because it does seem like I wouldn't say that they necessarily just preference the Old Testament over the New. It's that within both books, they pick and choose what they want. And just to be clear, I don't want to call out white evangelicals on this. The Bible, especially when you believe in the Old and New Testament, is incredibly large. And so the idea of saying you're a biblical literalist or you believe everything in the Bible, at some point you need to pick and choose and look at it through an interpretation. And so the fact that these evangelicals, these are the messages they're receiving in the pews, these are the things they're emphasizing, why different things get picked and chosen is a separate question. But
well, let me toss that to you, Anthea, but also, again, doing my homework for today, that evangelicals, and I think there's something like 80 million Americans who call themselves evangelicals, I believe that's correct, that Jesus is the savior of humanity. I mean, if that's what evangelicals believe, then I'm interested in what you say to Mary's question.
I am going to say something very different to Mary's question. So, Mary, if you're listening, part of what you hear is the ways in which the Bible has been used to create different kinds of beliefs and theologies. So one of the things that it sounds like it's Old Testament to you, but what it really is a way in which how people are pulling scriptures, whether that's Old Testament or New Testament or Hebrew Bible, you know, as you might want to call it, how they're pulling that together to make a worldview. So let me talk about something very specific right now that I think is really important to your question. There's a movement called the New Apostolic Reformation. And all of these people believe that there are seven mountains of power and that Christians should be in them and that there are demons that run the world and you should pray against them and all that. Now, for you, that may sound fantastic, but all of that stuff comes out of biblical beliefs and somebody has interpreted them a certain kind of way. And so when you look at the groups that we have now, I would even say that the messy part about this is that we say white evangelicals and we say 80 million people, but within that, there's all different kinds of evangelicals. And a lot of what is happening, especially right now, is that Pentecostals who have folded themselves into evangelicalism in certain kinds of ways are part of that milieu, and they have different ways of talking about scriptural beliefs. So if you hear people talk about the blood of Jesus or sort of kind of violent other kinds of things, those are different kind of evangelicals than those regular steeple kind of evangelicals that you believed in.
The steeple, meaning the one that go to the sort of regular church, I guess. Let me see what Nicole from, Colin from King of Prussia has to say. And Colin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Colin.
Hi,
go ahead. Yep, go ahead.
Marty, Professor Margolis, thank you. And Anthea, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a very conservative, traditional, Latinx-going Roman Catholic. And I just want to say I'm totally thrilled that Donald Trump is being impeached. And I'm going to be praying at daily mass that Mitch McConnell changes his own mind on matters. But I think you guys are talking about how the granularity of theological beliefs and traditions. And I went to a non-denominational Protestant undergrad, and so I kind of found being immersed in that there, you know, if you have 1,500 students, you could have, you know, 1,200, 1,300 different variations on the same theological topic. And so it's just, I think, if you don't have, as the Orthodox Church, Armenian Church, Catholic Church have, a magisterium of this is kind of what makes sense as an interpretation of the Bible, but no, it's just not my opinion, like, here's why, I think you might stop getting, as Father Harrison Ayer of the Canadian Diocese of Victoria says, you might stop getting a evangelicalism being Americanism with the veneer of Christianity.
Oh, that's interesting.
I also wanted to thank you, Professor Margolis, for quoting Father James Martin.
Fair enough. Colin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Do you want to take that?
Hi, Colin. I was actually the one that quoted Father Martin. We're friends. So that's number one. Number two is I'm not going to pick on you, but I'm going to say something else as somebody who is Catholic and has gone to Latin masses. One of the interesting things I think about all of this religion and politics thing is that Catholics are having their own internal battle. And that internal battle is between, you know, conservative Catholics and, you know, more liberal Catholics like me, for instance. And I'm interested that you'd say you'd go to Mass every day and pray for impeachment. I'm like, where are you going to Mass? I might join you. I think what part of this problem is about, it's not about a magisterium, because we know in Catholicism, you know, there's a magisterium, but people don't believe that all the time. There's ways in which they fight against that, too. And so I think there's a really good article, and that you can tweet at me later, by Antonio Spadaro, that talks about this melding between evangelicalism and Catholicism that happened. And it's a very good piece about how Catholics have been influenced by evangelicalism and some of these evangelical beliefs. And I think that will help you really kind of see where the question you're asking is going.
Colin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And as he was talking, Michelle, and we're almost up on a break here, I was thinking about Nancy Pelosi, who I believe is Catholic, has said multiple times, I pray for the president every day. And I always feel like there's a little stiletto knife, you know, as she says that. Any thoughts?
Absolutely. I think it's a way of her signaling that I, too, am religious. It doesn't matter that she is the Democratic Speaker of the House. It doesn't matter that she represents San Francisco in a very liberal place. She herself prays, and saying that she prays for Donald Trump is both saying something about herself, but also where she stands relative to the president, because I don't think the president is probably praying for anyone on a daily basis. That would be my guess.
That would be your guess. And that is Michelle Margolis, who joins us along with Anthea Butler. We're talking about religion and politics. Lots of people wanting to join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're going to take a very short break. And after the break, we'll hear from Paula White. She is president of Trump's spiritual advisor.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michelle Margolis and Anthea Butler about religion and politics. Let me read some comments here, and then we have one more clip that I want to play, a comment from Annabelle. Why do these supposed Christians support the most unchristian person? It seems so counterintuitive. A comment from Susan. Your guest said that there are two lenses for people of faith to look through: justice issues or traditional values issue. This is a simplistic view of Christians. Many of us look through both lenses. A comment from Edward. In the evangelical church, younger voters are pushing to recognize climate change. Some of these traditional conservative social issues within the church are shifting with younger members. Let me play a clip from Paula White. She's a prosperity gospel pastor. She's a televangelist, and she was just appointed President Trump's Faith and Opportunity Initiative leader. She is also the president's spiritual advisor, and here she is in a clip talking about viewers being mandated by God to send money to build fellow televangelist Jim Baker a TV studio.
And you have got to right now become one of those pillars, become one of those people, whether it's the 10,000 or the 1,000. And with all due respect, as great as that name is going to be left there, there's a greater name that's going to be written. Every treasure you give here on earth is being stored up in heaven. There is a department of treasury in heaven. Now, I know Mnuchin's over down here, but I'm telling you, there's a department of treasury in heaven that God is watching over everything you do, and you are storing up eternal treasure that will go so far beyond, I think, that we can even begin to imagine, that you are mandated by God. I feel a mandate. I know I was supposed to come share my book, but I feel a mandate to help you build this.
Anthea, didn't Jesus throw the money makers out of the temple?
He sure did, and I can't imagine what he might do right now to all these, like, corporate Christians we have. Yeah, Paula Weiss.
There's nothing new about this.
This is nothing new. This is nothing new. This has come from the 19th century, you know, if we talk about science of mind and all of that, and then develop into prosperity gospel. Paula White's an interesting figure because she's been around for a long time. She started in the 90s with T.D. Jakes. She has a television show. She's moved from church to church. She, you know, depending on how you view it, she either took over a church in Orlando or she stole a church. So, we'll leave that up to speculation because I don't know. And, you know, her relationship to the president now makes her a very, you know, probably one of the most powerful female figures in the country right now in terms of religion, which is sort of making the rest of these guys nervous, I have to say.
Oh.
But I think this way in which she's asking for money here is about two different things. I mean, you think about it, Jim Baker had his own scandal in the 80s, right? He's still around right now. He sells, doomsday supplies. He's in outside of Branson, Missouri. There's a really good piece by Sarah Posner that I tweeted out this morning about him saying that Elijah Cummings was one of Donald Trump's enemies, and that he, you know, what happens to God's enemies of God is that they die. So this is the kind of man that she's supporting and asking you to send money to. So I think you have to put all that in perspective to say that what we have is a corporatized Christianity on the side of the prosperity gospel people like Paula White, but it's also politicized. And so free markets and their version of Jesus go together very well. And they're about certain kinds of things. And the other thing I want to say just very briefly is that, you know, this is also couched in a sense of, in a way in which these people look like they're all for interracial cooperation. And that is really important because they're trying to give you a sense in which that we're progressive. We have everybody there. But when it comes time for leadership, it's all white people. And so I think, you know, that is something that we really need to be careful about when we're talking about these people and watch how they behave with people of color.
Michelle, you were saying during the break, in reference to one of our callers who called us right before the break, Colin, about, people will say, I'm an evangelical, I'm a born-again Christian, I'm a this, I'm a that, but how they define it is really unique to them. They don't necessarily, you know, they're not, they didn't go to divinity school. They believe this, they believe what they believe because it makes sense to them, or it's connected to their family or their neighborhood or whatever.
Absolutely. I was in Alabama for 6 weeks interviewing white evangelicals of varying degrees of religiosity and also pastors themselves. And I would start out with the survey question, do you consider yourself an evangelical or born again Christian? And had them answer the question like they were taking a survey, and then we would unpack it. And for every person I talked to, they had a different understanding of what an evangelical was and what a born again Christian was. And they might be one but not the other. But, you know, some of them and very few of them had a really good grasp on what that meant. And again, it's not to say that Americans are dumb or don't know anything about religion, but it says something about how complicated it is to study a group when some of the ways we define it, and something also Anthea said is maybe we do it based on what church you go to, but then we're combining a whole bunch of people with different sets of beliefs. And also, just because you go to a church doesn't mean you're getting, you believe the things that theologians and religious scholars said that denomination should be espousing or generally espouses. And so it's a very, very complicated question that we're left with as scholars when we want to say something about white evangelicals in politics. This fundamental question of who are evangelicals is a thorny one.
Let me get some more callers in on the conversation. Looks like we've got Maureen from Jenkintown. And Maureen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm an older, white, liberal, college educated, and I'm born again, and I could be considered evangelical, and I think Donald Trump is a disgrace. I don't understand why people can't step out of their cubbyholes and just look at the facts. every impeachment article, both impeachment articles, are supported in writing and out of his own mouth. I don't understand how people can willfully blind themselves. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Anthea, can you help Maureen?
Yeah, I think part of what's going on right now where you talk about people willfully blinding themselves, there's two ways to talk about it. One is a biblical way and one is a sort of academic way. Now I'm going to talk about the academic way. I think people have to hold on to this for dear life, because if they don't, it all falls apart. And also, you have to understand that he's done things for like evangelicals really want. He's appointed tons of judges. You have two Supreme Court judges. You know, he's hopeful for a third before he, you know, goes out of this first term, actually. And so all of the things that he's done, he's kept the promises to them. And for them, this is really important. It's like, we don't really care, you know, how many wives he's had or, you know, what are all these other things. He's God's man. And so for them, to not believe in him is almost like not believing in God. And I know that sounds really strange and that doesn't line up with most people. But I have to say that I think that in this particular case, it really does, which is why, you know, you see all the machinations about people trying to back him up, whether that was yesterday with politicians or religious leaders. You know, this is their horse. They bet on it. They don't want to lose.
Well, let me quote from Rick Perry, who was interviewed on Fox News talking about the president and God. And Rick Perry said, God uses imperfect people through history. King David wasn't perfect. Saul wasn't perfect. Solomon wasn't perfect. And I actually gave the president a one-pager on those Old Testament kings about a month ago. And I shared with him, I said, Mr. President, I know there are people who say that you are the chosen one.
This is something I think a lot of people have been saying, and I don't know whether it comes about organically or they heard this, they're repeating what they've heard on Fox News, but this idea of an empty vessel, making references to Saul and David, is very common. The idea that God can use an imperfect person to bring about God's plan is a very common trope. And so getting back to Maureen's question, that's an explanation, that Trump does not need to be godly to be chosen by God. And I think that is an explanation, whether or not that is convincing to you or reasonable to you. That is a reason. And this gets back to the idea of when you have a really, really big Bible, mm-hmm. you can find biblical justifications for pretty much anything you want to believe. And there are stories of very flawed men being anointed by God. And so it's easy to make that connection with Trump today.
Yeah, go ahead, Anthony.
I just want to tie in with what was just being said. If you really want to go look at this in more detail, I would really strongly urge you to look at the 5-part series on Netflix called The Family about my friend Jeff Charlotte. It's fantastic. And it talks about how all of this kind of political thinking about strong men who don't really believe anything but can work for evangelicals and work for God and be those empty vessels, so to speak, but are being called by God, are trained. And I think, you know, between his two books about this, The Family and C Street, and that Netflix thing, that'll give you a really good explanation of understanding why this kind of thinking has gone into regular everyday parlance.
It's interesting. We spent the whole hour talking about Christianity, but we are a religiously diverse country, and I guess becoming more religious. Obviously, Judeo-Christian we talk about, but we've got Muslims, we've got Hindus, we've got other people of different faiths coming to this country. And I wonder, Michelle, you know, looking, I guess, into your crystal balls of how if Christianity and I guess just by numbers will be sort of there'll be fewer Christians in the country, how that might mix all this stuff up.
I think it can mix it up in two important ways. First, we are going to not be a majority white Christian country very soon. And that's going to have just political implications from numbers. But it also has a lot to do with I think, and this is something Anthea talked about earlier in the hour, I think what we're seeing is the start of the reaction to that, right? So evangelicals, white evangelicals traditionally have this evangelical persecution complex. But what does it mean if they're both their faith and their demographics of white is shrinking in influence, right? Even though they are still the dominant party, dominant groups, both in terms of numbers, but also in terms of influence. They have outsized influence, white Christians in America. But if they have become relatively less important as minority groups have entered the country and taken on political positions and leadership in the United States, they're going to react to that, right? There's this distinction between they can still be absolutely quite powerful, but feel like they are relatively less so. And that's when we're going to see a lot of this kind of clinging to things. This is why we might be you might see people supporting Donald Trump, accepting racist and bigoted tropes because they feel like they're on the losing end of something.
Do you want to answer that, and then we'll get back to our calls?
Yeah, I think that what's important when we see this demographic change is to not just think about it in terms of demographic change, but also will other religions be hardened? And the way I'm really thinking about this is to think about someplace across the world, and that is India and what is happening with Narendra Modi and the Hindus versus the Muslims. So, you know, it's not just Christianity. This could happen anywhere. It's more about what fundamentalism is and what nationalism is. And so our, you know, the problem here in America is that if people pick up these nationalistic tropes that are not necessarily, you know, white evangelical Christian, what will that mean? Now, I think that that's probably not going to happen in America. But if that does happen, then we get more of the same. And so that's really, to me, the fundamental underlying issue of all of this is how do you have fundamentalist religious beliefs, and nationalism put together to make a very potent mix that cuts other people out of the equation.
Well, something to be very mindful of. Let me get, looks like Joanne from Bartow. And Joanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you, ladies, all of you.
Sure.
I lived in Canada for 18 years and 3 years in Denmark. And both countries have multiple political parties. And I have witnessed friends and family debate politics vehemently and then get up from the dinner table, hug each other, say goodbye. And it never seemed to affect their relationship or their respect for their mutual faith. And then I moved here and have lived here for 30 years in the States in this two-party system with this bizarre filter that if you are evangelical / non-denominational Christian, you're Republican. And
I hear you. I mean, it sounds like you resist that, Joanne. Let me give Michelle a chance to respond to your call. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, it's tricky and it's very different. I do think that one thing that by virtue of living in a two-party system means that no one is probably completely happy with the stances of their political party. And not to say that you are in Europe or Canada, but because you have more options, you can get the religious leftist party in the way that you can't have here. And so the fact, and I think that there's a lot to be said for when you have to make compromises on your beliefs, your political beliefs, if you have to join a political team that maybe doesn't match up, you psychologically want to double down and be on that team even more because you know you're making an internal compromise. And instead of saying they're not that great, but it's the best I can do in a two-party system, you instead become an even more devout partisan than if you were just able to be on a team like a religious leftist party where you don't actually need to make any trade-offs. And consequently, I think people, that's how our partisan identities become these strong identities in America and make it so that these discussions at the dinner table become, you know, carry over into the rest of your life where you might have some problems with your family members.
Let me read a comment from Virginia. Nanthia, I'll toss it to you. She says, I'm an ordained pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and have appreciated the discussion today. Many of us are very concerned about justice issues, but always return to the gospel message of Jesus as a sort of final thought.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I mean, if you're what people call a red letter Christian, then, you know, Jesus was about justice. He was about, you know, picking up the downtrodden. That's all what Luke chapter 4 is about, right? So I think it's a way in which people don't hear each other right now, and they don't hear what each other is talking about. The person who wrote in and said, I was making a very, you know, simplistic distinction between justice Christians and evangelicals. I would say to that person, yes, that may seem like that to you, but you go try to talk to somebody else and say, well, I believe, you know, that in pro-life, but I'm also a liberal and don't think that this thing, and you'll see how the conversation will deteriorate because people can't hold these things together. They think that that's a problem for them. And they get very politicized in America. And I think the problem is for us is that we've allowed certain groups to have louder voices. And part of that, you know, I have to say, you know, even though I'm on a radio show, is that that's been the media because it's easier to get a soundbite from a white evangelical than it is to go find somebody who has nuance. And people don't know how to write about nuance very well. So that's why, you know, I'm especially appreciative that Michelle has paid attention to this as a political scientist, because I'll admit that I have been really hard on political scientists sometimes. But I think that this is part of what we need to start to think about religion in these kinds of very sophisticated ways instead of very simplistically.
Well, we could go on. Seems like a good place to stop. Anthea Butler, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. And again, Associate Professor of Religious Studies and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, currently Presidential Fellow at Yale Divinity School. And she's got a forthcoming book about evangelicals and racism. Michelle Margolis, thank you for joining us as well. And she's an Assistant Professor of Political Science, also at the University of Pennsylvania. Wrote a book called From Politics to the Pews, How Partisanship and the Political Environment Shape Religion. Religious Identity. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those calls and comments. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.